Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. This episode is called What is Happening in This World? A Conversation with Stoey Part 2. So without further ado, I will see if I can give Stoey a quick call here. Bear with me. I hope your day is going well for you. It's been pretty good day for me overall, I would have to say, just kind of generally speaking. But life always has a few little challenges as far as that. You can probably hear it ring.
This is Stoey.
Stoey, how are you today, sir?
Good, Mark. Hey, can you hear me all right?
You sound real good to me. And, you know, I just feel compelled to play a little Native American flute music again. Just to kind of commemorate you being here. Bear with me.
Super, no problem.
This comes from Audio Jungle.
Audio Jungle.
You can hear her say this in the background. Audio Jungle. Okay, that's enough mood music, but I thought I'd play that.
Very nice. We'll put everyone to sleep.
Hey, some days we need that. We talked last show about a lot of really interesting things, and I'd like to go back. So we'll have to repeat a little bit, but that's okay. I think repetition
that's
is
fine.
Good. But I want to go back to the point where you said you had won an award, and I think you were in the military or in college, I'm not sure which.
Well, you may be talking about, so I served during Desert Storm and was a translator of Arabic language during the Gulf War, to include Desert Shield, which was before the war started, and then Desert Storm. And so while I was in school learning Arabic at Monterey, I received the Joint Service Achievement Medal, which is a very high medal. Essentially what it meant was I was the valedictorian of all the language classes that were going through the school about maybe 500 guys or so. And then later, when I was in Desert Storm, we translated for the troops over there for about 9 months. And at the end of that, I was awarded the Bronze Star for meritorious service. So.
Wow,
that was a real great honor, yeah.
So let's step back a little bit. You were in Desert Storm, and were you in Desert Shield as well?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay, and when you got this Joint Service Achievement Award, Were you in a school at this time? You were studying Arabic, right? You said you beat another 500 guys or something like that.
Yeah. So the military teaches a bunch of different strategic languages there, everything from Russian and Polish and Czech to Arabic and Farsi, and you know, any Chinese, any language you can think of that is used in the military intelligence corps.
So, and where were you exactly?
Monterey, California.
So you were in California at the time, and you were
in
the military.
Yeah, it was super, Mark.
You were
right.
You were what?
It was super. I loved California.
Yeah, you enjoyed it. How long were you out there?
About 18 months in Monterey.
And did you learn Arabic in 18 months, or did you know it before you got there?
No. I started studying. It was when we were there. So classes were 8 hours a day, and then they typically had 3 hours of homework in the evenings. So it was about 11 hours a day studying Arabic.
Wow, that sounds grueling.
It was, but you have to understand I had an interest in languages. By that time, I spoke fluent German and pretty good French, and wanted to add Arabic to that arsenal of languages. And so it was great. I loved it.
Was part of your desire to do that because you knew you'd be in California?
No, had nothing to do with California.
Okay.
Just the Arabic language. I was really interested in the Middle East.
Oh, really? And how long have you had an interest in Arabic in the Middle East? Your whole life, or?
It actually started when I served a mission for my church in Germany. I was there for 2 years, speaking German with German people, teaching about Christianity. And when I was in Germany, I met a lot of Turkish foreign workers. So Turks in Germany are kind of like Mexicans in the United States. They're seasonal workers and do a lot of the menial jobs or whatever. And so I met a number of Turkish families who were Islamic, and it was fascinating to me. They were just as anxious to convert me to Islam as I was to convert them to Christianity. And so it made for really wonderful and interesting discussions. And I thought, you know, this is a whole part of the world I don't know anything about. I need to learn about these guys.
Wow. And was Arabic difficult to learn? I mean, it probably has absolutely nothing in common with German or English, or does it? I don't know.
No, it's true, nothing. So the military actually categorizes languages from 1 through 5. So 1 being the easiest for an English speaker to learn, and 5 being the most difficult. And there are just a few languages that are classified as 5. Arabic is one of them. Finnish is one, a class 5 language, and I believe Korean is a class 5 language as well.
It seems like something like Chinese would be pretty difficult too.
You think, and Chinese is difficult, even for the Chinese, I think. But Korean has a little added element that Chinese does not have, apparently. Look, I'm not a specialist in Eastern languages, but in Korean, intonation that means a lot. And
no
so
kidding.
If you intone a word incorrectly, it's a completely different word.
Oh, my. That's confusing.
So the same word, just with a different accent on it. And we have some of that in English as well, but it's very prevalent in Korean, which brings that language up to the class 5 level.
Man, to me that would be so confusing. You're saying the same word, but a different intonation, and it can mean something different. Well, we have that, not so much an intonation, at least nothing I can think of, but like the word, I read the book, the fire truck is red. That's kind of confusing, but
yeah.
but they're saying just the intonation, like how loud you speak it or how softly or the
way or maybe the accent on the beginning of the word instead of the end, or you know, there's a little sing-songy emphasis, hey, versus you're,
the Oriental languages have that kind of sing-songy aspect.
They do, and I'm sorry, I just butchered something there. I'm sure
that is hilarious. Okay, so you got a Joint Service Achievement Award because you learned Arabic and you were at the very top of your class, and you were in Monterey, California. And then at some point,
yeah,
you got on a C-130 and you were dripping with sweat, and then the C-130 goes up to 30,000 feet, and it's cold as hell, and you're shivering. And
that's exactly right. It was one of the worst experiences of my life.
I'll
never forget climbing to 30,000 feet. It's just freezing on the inside of this plane. You're soaked with sweat from the tarmac where it was 95 degrees, and you were in full battle uniform, you know, just a few minutes earlier. And I literally shivered for hours until my body heat dried my uniform out.
It was
terrible.
You know, my body metabolism is kind of funny. Like sometimes if I sleep real deeply, my body temperature will go way up, and I'll do the same thing. I'll sweat my clothes. My clothes are all sweaty, and it's very uncomfortable. Huh. And it can be very cold as well. So I know in a very, very small way what you must have been experiencing. It's a good thing you didn't catch anything. You were
young and strong in those days.
And
good looking, too, I should add.
Of course. So you guys landed somewhere in the Middle East.
So first we landed in Egypt.
Yeah.
And we had a short layover there. And so I
How
remember.
How long were you in Egypt?
Not very long.
Hours. Oh, you didn't get to see anything.
No, I think the plane was just refueling.
But
I learned something. This is something that I learned, and it started in Egypt. So when we were told we were going to the Middle East, we said they told us we could take two duffel bags and a rucksack. And so I got the biggest military rucksack I could get and packed everything that I thought I had to have in two duffel bags. Now, those duffel bags will hold a lot. And a rucksack. Well, when we got to Egypt and came out of the plane with our gear, they said, look, from this point on, you have to leave one of the duffel bags. And I thought, oh, no, you know, I only packed everything that I absolutely had to have.
Jeez.
And so I unpacked my duffel bags and I repacked and I left one of the duffel bags behind. And what you know, Mark, within a couple of months, I could not remember a single thing that was in that first duffel bag that was so important for me to have.
Wow.
And then we arrived in Saudi Arabia, and when we got ready to go to the front lines, they came to us again and said, look, you can only take your rucksack. You have to leave your second duffel bag behind. And
wow.
I unpacked and repacked, and of course, mostly what I had was stuff I was required to have by the military: gas masks and uniforms, and you know, all of these kind of things. So we left that second duffel bag behind, and within a couple of months, once again, I could not remember a single thing that had been so important to me that I had to have it. And I found that as time went on, my rucksack got thinner and thinner. And finally, I had only the required military equipment that I was supposed to take with me, plus stamps and letters to write my family at home, and a copy of the scriptures. And I thought, you know, this is what it comes down to: your relationship with God and your relationship with other people is all that you are really left with in the end, and nothing else is really very important.
Well, that's an interesting analogy, almost like death, right?
Yeah, was exactly. In fact, when you go off to war, you know, you don't really expect to come back. You hope that you will, but you just don't know.
So you left Egypt, and where did you go from there?
Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
And, okay.
We were, for a few months, we were in at a military base that was very nice accommodations there in Riyadh. And then we were moved forward after a couple of months to the front lines. and accommodations were a tent for the rest of my time. for the next 6 months or whatever after we were moved forward, it was tents. And, so I can say I lived in a tent in the desert for about 6 months.
And that's, you were in Saudi Arabia at that time, still?
So most of that time spent in Saudi Arabia, but also a portion of that time spent in Iraq and Kuwait as well.
Okay. So did you have to go in like with, the guys that were shooting and sometimes speak Arabic or...
The answer is strangely yes. I did have to do that, and here's the deal: that not necessarily the war was over. Allies bombed the Iraqi army into non-existence before we ever stepped over the border, really, and so there wasn't much of an Iraqi army that was left, but. The military became the civil authority in southern Iraq for months, and part of my duty was translating for doctors while I was there, treating people in the refugee camp. But the other part of my duty was to translate for the police, the MPs, who were the civil authority, trying to keep order in this refugee area in southern Iraq. And there were a lot of touchy situations, when you don't know where your next loaf of bread is coming from, a loaf of bread becomes pretty important, and people will do really terrible and uncivilized things to get your loaf of bread. And so things like that were happening. And in addition to that, Kuwaitis were coming over the border and were selling military equipment to Iraqi civilians, and like machine guns, for example. And so I would go with the military police, and they got a tip, the machine gun sale was happening, and they would send in the linguist first. You go in and tell them to... stop the sale and drop their weapons. And, when someone's holding a machine gun, it's really exciting to approach them and tell them they're about to be arrested by the military police. I was in some really touchy situations over there. But seen in retrospect, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right? And I came through and really had a pretty positive experience.
Did you, since you weren't a native speaker, and you had only known Arabic for like a year and a half, even though you were first in your class, did you ever run into any kind of sticky situations in translations where you were thinking, wow, I've never heard that. I don't remember that from the book or something like that?
Well, of course, Arabic is a very difficult language, and I was not 100% right, and maybe I wasn't even 50%, but I was good enough to translate the military things that needed to be translated. I did run into a situation once that you have this idea of the Middle East, with Bedouins and camels and tribes roaming through the desert, et cetera, and a lot of that is really true. And some of it is not. And let me give you an example. Our colonel had decided that they were going to have a missile practice, firing some missiles from that were vehicle-mounted missiles. Mm-hmm. And so they had established a training area where they were going to do this out in the desert. And there were some Bedouins that were living there. And so my job was to go to the Bedouin encampment and tell the Bedouins they had to move their tents 5 kilometers to the south to be out of the danger area. And so I go off to the Bedouin encampment, and we get there. They're hospitable, and they welcome us into the tent. And pretty soon a big silver bowl of camel's milk appears that's just been milked out of the camel. And they start passing it around the circle, and everybody's supposed to drink this warm camel's milk. And And so after we get accommodated there, so it was now time to talk, right? So in Arabic, I said to them, you know, my mission today is to come and tell you that the military has established a firing range in this area. They're going to be launching missiles, and you and your camels that are here are in danger. You need to move your tents 5 kilometers to the south. And there was a deep silence, and they just looked at me. Nothing, no expression, nothing. And I thought, okay, here's my first failure of communication. They didn't understand a word I said. And so I decided to slow down, right? So I slowed down and said, there is a military firing range established in this area, blah, blah, tip on to the end. And then I stopped and they said, yes, you just said that.
And
I said, okay, well, you understood me. What is the problem? They said, the problem is that we have lived in this tent on this spot for 15 years. We are not moving our tent 5 kilometers to the south. You move your firing range 5 kilometers to the north. And I swear, it looked like they had just arrived yesterday. There was no improvement on this property, and it looked like the tent had just been set up here in the middle of the desert. And to my eye, it looked like maybe they had just arrived, you know, in the last week or whatever. But they had been here for 15 years. Now, I relayed this information to the colonel, and indeed, the military ended up moving their firing range 5 kilometers to the north. But that was just an example of a situation where things did not turn out like you thought they were going to turn out. And, you know,
that's amazing that the military would do that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Move 5 kilometers.
Be accommodating like that. It's a big desert,
yeah.
You know.
I guess it is, but still. They probably had a lot of equipment that had to move, I would guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
Did you have so you were translating in these kind of situations, and the war was basically over at this point?
So the firing range discussion took place before the beginning of the ground war.
Okay.
And, but most of my experience was after the ground war started. I did have some responsibilities prior to the ground war starting, where I was assessing terror threats against our military bases that were in the north of Saudi Arabia. There was some concern that some of the Shiite Muslims were unhappy that the Americans were there. Saudi Arabia is a Sunni Muslim kingdom, and the Shiites at that time, anyway, were the terrorist brand of Islam, and the Americans had a concern that Shiites would attack our four bases that were in northern Saudi Arabia. So part of my job was to assess the threat against those bases, and what we found was the threat was pretty small. While it was true that Shiites did not love Americans, it turns out what they hated even more than Americans was the oncoming Iraqi army. And they loved having the Americans between that army and them. So it all worked out.
So the Sunni and the Shiites are always fighting? Is that true?
Well, you know, they disagree, like a lot of religious sects. They disagree on some fundamental doctrines in Islam, and the Saudis, who see themselves as the defender of the faith, and are Sunni, and they treat other Islamic sects, you know, differently, let's just say, in Saudi Arabia than they do Sunni Muslims.
Hey, that seems like, you know, we're almost out of time. I can't believe this time has gone so quick. We've only got like 5 minutes left.
My goodness, Mark, where does the time go?
It's a time warp, I'm telling you. So I hope you're willing to keep we'll keep plodding through this, I hope. I mean, it's so interesting.
Oh,
so,
yeah, we'd be glad to.
So it's 5 minutes. We got 5 minutes left, so I don't want to pull you in a topic that's too huge. But did you feel like that you got a much better understanding of the Islamic faith while you were there or not?
You know, over the years, I have gotten a better understanding of the Islamic faith. I had read a good portion of the Quran before I went over to Saudi Arabia and was familiar with, you know, the five pillars of Islam that are the pillars of the faith of Islam. But there's something that in the West we do not understand. And that is that even though there are sects within Islam, Islam is a much more monotheistic faith than or monolithic faith than Christianity. Christianity literally has, you know, 50,000 different brands or whatever. Mm-hmm. But five times a day at the same time, throughout the entire world, Muslims bow down and pray toward Mecca. And this unites them in a way that it is very difficult for Westerners to understand. And there are other parts of their faith that are like that as well. So five times a day based on Mecca time, wherever you are, if you're in Chicago, when it is, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning in Mecca, you bow down and pray toward Mecca. And it is a very powerful feature of Islam that unites them together that we just don't comprehend very well as Westerners.
Back when I was in the office, the guy that sat next to me was Muslim, and he would go off into a little conference room at times to pray. Yeah. I don't know if I was assuming he was doing something like that. Although, 2-3 minutes left. This is the wrong topic to end on, but I just thought of this. There are some extreme practices in Islam, like with the female genital mutilation. Is that normal or is that unusual?
So, it is normal, especially in rural, in the rural parts of the Middle East, which are more fundamentalist than, you know, the big cities or whatever. So female genital mutilation is a standard practice in some places. Yeah.
Ooh, that's scary stuff. I'm glad they don't. I'd hate to be over there and, you know, have to endure that or see something like that. I mean, you've had some very incredible adventures, Stoey. I've really hit a gold mine here.
You're all kind.
I appreciate it very much. We've only got like a minute 50 seconds left. Any closing thoughts for this show?
Yeah. So I would say this, especially if your listeners are thinking about the Middle East. In the Middle East, their calendar is about 500 years different than ours. You know, it's 2000 whatever here, and it's 15 whatever in the Middle East,
wow.
Because they date from the birth of Muhammad, whereas we date from Jesus Christ. And in many ways, that culture is different than ours in ways that we don't understand in our modern times. But if you turn back the clock in the West, you know, we think that we're so progressive, et cetera, and that, you know, women's rights, for example, are so different than they are in the Middle East. Well, they are different than they are in the Middle East, but they are not, and they're also very different than they were in the West 100 years ago or 150 years ago. But it's important to remember that in the Middle East, for example, in Saudi Arabia, people were living in tribes in the desert the way they lived for thousands of years until the 1950s when Abdulaziz became the king of Saudi Arabia. And so as a quote-unquote civilized nation, Saudi Arabia has only been there since the 1950s. And, you know, we just can't expect the kind of societal progress in the Middle East that the West has had hundreds of years to develop to suddenly take place all at once in the Middle East. And I think that's a perspective that a lot of Westerners need to have. Instead of comparing how we are now with how the Middle East is, we need to compare how we were 100 years ago or 200 years ago with how the Middle East is, because that's how long we've been developing our society here in the U.S.
Great way to end the show. Stoy, fascinating conversation again. Have a great day, man. I appreciate you coming on.
Great to talk to you, Mark.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.